Let's restart. It's funny because last time we taught, 15 minutes between sessions seemed to be too long. Now I picked 10, and that seems to be too short. So I guess we're going to have to decide, is it 12 or 12 and a half or who knows what? At any rate, just continuing this thought, not is something that you will use. And the thing to remember there is simply, it's sometimes more convenient to say what you don't want rather than what you do. So in this case, where I want to say I want everything that's not a digit, turns out that there's 128 ASCII characters. They use 7 bits of the word. So if I wanted to say everything that's not a digit, I'd have to say 118 different characters. And that's surely something I didn't want to do. So instead I used the not. And again, we'll see shortly when we talk about strings that sometimes it's easier to say I want to exclude unprintables, or by implication I want to include everything that is printable. And sometimes it's easier to say here are all the things that are printable and not printable, and simply say not, and that means I get all the printables instead. So we are talking then again about not, and so not EOL is something that I was talking about. And again, EOL is simply my way of writing down / new line, an alternative notation. So, and there it is in terms of quote / N. So I may want to exclude particular characters like the new line and accept everything else. And here's something, if you have paper, what happened is there's a not that applies to entire sets. But it turns out that for some reason the overbar in PowerPoint is not coming out cleanly, and I'm not quite sure why. Anybody who knows more about PowerPoint? So if you have a printed copy, that thing that's second bottom from the line from the bottom, that sort of thing that looks like Morse code, is meant to be an overbar. And it came out partially but not completely, and I have no idea why. I simply converted from PostScript down to PowerPoint, and it didn't come out cleanly. Also, the line where it says we define S, and there's something looks like a blotch right around above the E, that's meant to be an overbar. Fortunately, we're not going to use this concept very often, so it doesn't really matter that much that the overbar is messed up, except if you're wondering what the heck happened and you have a paper copy, you might want to take a pen or a pencil and correct it. Anybody who knows enough about PowerPoint to tell me how to do an overbar properly, that'd be great. You know, that's one of the troubles with having certain systems where it shows you what you can do, but it doesn't tell you how to do the things that it didn't bother to include as options. Sometimes they're a workaround, sometimes they're not. So in this one, I don't know what the workaround is, but it's only going to appear on this one slide, so I thought I'd just talk you through it and not worry too much more about it. As I showed you earlier, it's sometimes convenient also when you know you want to have exactly the right number of repetitions to put a numeric superscript to say I want exactly 10 copies of A or 32 or 64 or something. So just like star means zero or more, plus means one or more, K, where K is a number, means exactly that many. And occasionally that's useful. So here's a continuation of that. So if I wanted to talk about all 32-bit strings, I would simply say 0 or 1 to the 32nd, which means repeat that choice exactly 32 times. And that would be a handy way so I didn't have to count. I would let the computer specification count for me. So let's run into some examples. And some of these I kind of hinted at. So let's let D be the set of the 10 single digits. Remember, I could write that down by simply saying 0 or 1 or 2. Happens there's an easier way I'll show you a bit later to do it. And I could write down letters to be all 52 letters, 26 upper and 26 lower, and just write them all down. And I give them names just like I would in algebra, where I can have a symbolic name so I don't have to write down a big, long symbol. Turns out in JLEX we can actually give symbolic names to expressions and have the expression be substituted, rather much like in algebra where let x equal this big, long formula, and whenever you write down x, it means whatever the formula means. So here's something that we're actually using in our language, actually not quite, but pretty close. But in this particular case, this is a single line comment. And it begins with a double slash. And here's where I said, what's the definition of a single line comment? It goes from double slash to the end of the line. How do you know there's the end of the line? Well, you look for an end of line character. So it says, I'll accept anything that's not an end of line character. Might be zero of those. So guess what? It's told you something you probably never worried about, and rightly so. Let me switch my mode. Namely, if I have a program, A equals B, semicolon, and I write down a double slash and nothing more, is that a legal single line comment? In slightly more precise terms, that says, is it legal to have a comment whose body is empty? It's not always clear in this, and you're programming it, so if you were programming an ordinary scanner, you'd have to look up in the manual and say, is this legal or not? They might not even bother to tell you because it's such a silly little question. But we go back to our definition. Here we have a precise answer. And that's another advantage of this notation is the notation is very precise in what it includes or excludes. So it says, in this case, if I had a double slash, and notice that the not EOL is qualified by a star, which means zero or more choices. So if I want to do zero and have the end of line, that's perfectly fine. In fact, there's one case that this does not include that our definition does include. Namely, if you look at a text file, they're separated by ends of line. But if I take the very last line in a program, or if I have a program that's exactly one line long, we're talking about, you know, in some languages, people play games about actually writing a program that's a single line long, immensely more characters than a single line usually has, just to show it can be done. So in this particular case, is it legal to have a program that ends not with an end of line, but with nothing at all, essentially the end of file? That's really getting down to, is an end of line a line terminator or a line separator? Most people think of it as a terminator, but it really can be thought of as a separator. And that means the very last line in a comment, very last line that has a comment at the end, need not end with an end of line. So this definition actually is not quite fully inclusive. And it happens that our definition says that a comment is a double slash and a not end of line star, but it doesn't match the end of line. What it does instead is this end of line, as we'll see, is something called white space. And white space is normally ignored because it's invisible to the compiler. It's there for users to space something out or to get line structure. So this definition of comment includes an end of line that's normally perfectly okay, but there are obscure special cases where a program might end and not end in an end of line and still have a comment legally there. So we have a slightly more inclusive definition, which seems a little strange, but turns out that last time I taught it, I did it that way, and I had at least one student who said, nah, do it the right way, don't do it the easy way. So he converted me, and now we're going to do it the right way, not the easy way. Oh, here's something that's interesting, namely, if I wanted to write down a fixed decimal literal, that is something that has digits both on the left and right-hand side of a decimal point, here's a way of doing it. I say, give me one or more digits, and the dot represents the actual decimal point symbol. In this case, I don't have to escape it or quote it. It just means dot. And then one or more trailing digits. So you say, is 12.345 included? The answer is yes, it is. What's not included, and depending on back when you took science or engineering, it's a question is, do you consider, we had 12.345. But do you consider 12 point or 0.345 legal numbers? If you remember hearing about something called scientific notation, sometimes they require digits on both sides of the decimal point. Programming languages these days are a little more lax, and they actually can allow a number ending with a decimal point without digits on both sides. But again, that's a matter of definition. So the thing I have up here is fairly strict. Well, you say, hey, I know what I'll do. I'll make life easier by being smarter than that guy was. So let me go back and there we go. Let's smarten up that definition. So We had D plus dot D plus. And the negative thing about that is it does not include a number that has a decimal point but digits on one side or the other. So they say, oh, I know how to improve that. Does that work? No. It's one of those things, be careful what you ask for because you may just get it. Remember, this is a definition. If you write it down and it has bad consequences, too bad. You wrote down the bad definition. Now, that happens all the times in laws. You know, the lawyers, the legislators write down a law, and some clever person finds a loophole in it and says, well, you didn't exclude that, so is it legal or not? What's wrong with this definition? It does, by the way, include 9 point or 0.123, which is good. It also includes just the dot. And you're going to have to do some song and dancing to get me to believe that a dot without numbers anywhere is a real number. So in this case, it included too much. And that's possibly a negative thing. Sometimes a too simple definition will allow things you never intended to allow. So what would happen in this particular case, we'll get back to it, but you could do something like, we'll get to an example later where we'll flesh it out. I want to make sure I don't make an error by doing it off the top of my head. But there's a simple example that is not quite as complicated as we may get. Here's this thing I talked about previously, that I could take an integer literal, that'd be D plus, and give it an optional sign. So I can have a plus or minus or lambda. And by the way, I quote the plus because remember there's this plus operator. And I want to make it perfectly clear to the system and to the readers that the plus at the bottom line is not meant to be the repetition operator. It's meant to be the actual character plus used as a plus sign in this particular case. The minus in this stage doesn't have any magic powers yet. And a little later on we'll show you that minus can have a special usage too, in which case it may have to be quoted. But at this stage it doesn't because we haven't introduced that notation yet. And again, why the quotes on the plus? Because plus, we don't want misunderstood as an operator. Okay, here's something we actually use exactly as shown in our language. And this is the famous multi-line comment. It happens that, of course, Java and C and a lot of other languages use an alternative, blah, blah, blah. This is multi-line so that you have slash star beginning and star slash ending, possibly on different lines. So many languages have a single line comment, which just extend for that one line, or they have a block comment or multi-line comment. Typically, it begins with different characters. Turns out, although you've seen that probably in Java, if nothing else, or possibly in C or C++, many languages have it, writing down a definition for that that's proper is very difficult. It's sort of like this thing I had before about digit star dot digit star, looking like it ought to work, but doesn't quite. And what we'll do later on is have a homework assignment. In fact, you can work on it, or if you're cheaters, you can dig it off the internet. You can actually dig out a definition that does work. But the obvious ones, you got to be a little careful with, because the difficulty with this is you have to give a definition that does not allow a star slash to appear within the body. Why is that? Well, something you may have noticed to your chagrin, and this turns out to be really a problem with the scanner, is that multi-line comments, block comments, do not nest. Most other things nest. That means you can put one thing inside of another. Expression can be a sub-expression in something bigger. A loop can appear in the body of another loop, that sort of thing. An if statement can have components that are also if statements. But it turns out that you're not allowed to have comments within comments. So if I write this down, what a scanner or a human being might do is say, that's the end of the comment right there, and all this other gobbledygook up to the star slash is not part of the comment body, but rather it's just ordinary characters. It'd probably be misscanned and certainly be misinterpreted. So that sort of comment is nice, but it's hard to get right. We will do it, but it's simply something that we're going to have a little more experience on. So what we're going to have is an alternative comment that's a little easier to get right. And what it is, it's a comment that begins with a double pound sign and ends in a double pound sign. Inside the text, I can have anything including a single pound sign that doesn't have a neighboring pound sign. So what you're allowed to have, well, let me just give you some examples. So you're allowed to have something like pound sign ABC. So it can appear on one line, or it can appear on multiple lines, where you give your name and the program and all that and end it with double pound sign. That's fine. Or you can have a single pound sign inside the text, like we're number one. That would be allowed. So we want to have a definition that's inclusive enough for all those, and it's still fairly simple to understand. So here's what we're going to have, and let's explain why it works. And here's a case again for lambda. Remember I said where lambda represents an option that you may or may not choose. So one of the funny things about this is that we actually can understand comments or definitions sometimes not left to right, as you ordinarily do with words, but sometimes from outside in or inside out. So let me go on a piece of paper because I'm not allowed to write on the screen. And what I'll do is I'll copy down this definition from the screen here. Okay, that should be the same definition. And you say to yourself, how can I understand that this really works? As I said a moment ago, sometimes this is easier to understand by understanding it from the outside in. What I mean on that is you say, okay, it begins with a double pound sign, it ends with a double pound sign. That's fine. Question number one, can it have a common body that has zero additional characters? That is pound sign, pound sign, pound sign, pound sign. Is that a legal comment? Well, you say, in this case, you know, you don't have to go to your lawyer or you know, to your religious leader or anything like that. Ask for divine or professional guidance. You look at the definition. And although I've written it a little bit sloppy, notice that the whole body is enclosed by a star. That means I can choose to do the entire body zero times. So that's fine. Well, let's verify that it can include anything that doesn't include a pound sign. That's the ordinary thing. And the question is, how does that work? Remember, it just has to allow it. We don't have to tell the parser which choice to make. So in this particular case, he's got a choice. Namely, he can match a pound sign or lambda. The way you match lambda is by matching nothing, of course. So what I can do is I can simply repeatedly take this little guy and let it match lambda. If so, it'll match anything that's not a pound sign. Notice that includes, in this particular case, a new line, a blank, a tab, or anything else. Hey, wait a minute. This thing allows unprintables. Should I allow that? Notice I kind of preached against it when I had a quoted string, but what's different between this and a quoted string? This is comments, and comments don't affect a program. So you can imagine in this particular case, for example, there are some characters, and it changes from system to system, but what you can actually do if you have the right set of unprintables is change your video from normal video to reverse video. Now, some people love that, and some people absolutely hate it. It used to be the case if you accidentally listed out the wrong series of characters, you go to reverse video. What that means on some terminals that the background is all black instead of white, and the characters are white instead of black. It really catches your attention. I find it kind of hard to read, but you may have seen it. And it's actually possible with the right set of unprintable characters to change from ordinary video to reverse video and then back again, if you want to be crazy enough to do it. So we are going to allow unprintables. We could exclude them, but that makes the definition harder. And the notion is if the comment is hard to read, you wrote the comment, it's not going to affect the program, we'll let you have maximum latitude because I don't have to say what the program does. Just read the comment. And if you made the comment unreadable, that's your problem, not mine. But suppose I want a pound sign. How do I get it? Well, I put a pound sign down, but notice it says immediately I put a pound sign down, I have to write something that's not a pound sign. The reason for that is, in this particular case, if I was allowed to have a second pound sign, that would terminate me prematurely. And I don't want that. I'm not allowed. So the claim is this little gizmo in the center can generate single pound signs, but can never generate two adjacent pound signs. And that being the case, it'd be the situation here that this opens the comment and that closes the comments, and everything except two consecutive pound signs are included. That's kind of what we would like to do with the slash star star slash, but it turns out because they're different characters that that's a little harder. So anyway, that's the history there, and this could be used as an alternative multi-line comments. At some point, by the way, you're thinking about in future if you want extra credit down the line, one of the things you could do, it's not too hard, particularly since we'll handle that before the semester is very far along, is extend the language to allow star slash slash star comments. That'd be a nice thing to have. It's just at this stage, I'm not quite in the position where I want to define them. And if I don't define them, I can't ask you to implement them. It's one of those situations, you're not responsible to program anything if I can't tell you what I want. Don't you wish all your supervisors were that good? And say, don't tell me, how to do it. Just do it. You know, make it work. And what do you mean? I don't know. Make it work. And sometimes you get supervisors like that. Says you got to make the decision of what's right and wrong. And that's a lot harder because if you make the wrong decision, you get hammered for what's not your problem. You're not the person who specifies the program. You're the person that implements the program. So at least in this class, I'll try to tell you as precisely as possible what I want. And therefore, you're only responsible for implementing what I ask for. But remember, be careful what you ask for because you just may get it. So that's why the comment is like that. Although we haven't gone too far, one of the cool things about computing is that sometimes it's possible to show that things that seem reasonable are impossible. So here's something that comes up in programming languages quite routinely that cannot be handled by the scanner. And in fact, I alluded to that maybe 5 minutes ago. This is the case where I have a set of balanced brackets. And let me use the mathematical notation to make it a little more precise. This is the case where I have exactly M open brackets followed by M closed brackets. Real programming languages allow that, but not in the scanner. That's handled by a more powerful device called the parser. So if you have, for example, nested blocks, you're allowed to have open brace, closed brace, and another open brace, closed brace, etc. But it's actually possible to show that a scanner, using regular notation as I'm developing, cannot possibly recognize that exact set. I won't show that yet. I'll show that in future. But I can actually make a sound mathematical argument, real mathematics that will keep mathematicians happy, that this thing cannot possibly be generated using the notation we have. Well, what does that matter? Well, because of this problem, we get back to this problem that I talked about a moment ago, namely, one of the things that you cannot do, unfortunately, is nest blocked comments. So I could say A equals 1 and have a comment. And here I'll use this slash star star slash notation. And then B equals 2. And you may have done this, but all of a sudden you decide, hey, I don't want to have these two statements in my program quite yet, so I'll do a common trick. I'll comment them out. The way you comment them out is put a slash star and a star slash around the program you want to deactivate. The notion is that the A gets 1 and B gets 2 become comment, and therefore they're not executable, but I haven't destroyed the text. Now, I've tried to do that, and I'm sure you tried to do that many times, and it doesn't work. Some languages have a variety of comments so that a different kind of comment can be used at one level versus another. But the reason it doesn't work is because in this situation, the first time you see a star slash, it terminates the opening this, and therefore this much is commented out, but not the remainder. And it's simply because scanners do not allow matching constructs like star slash and star slash to nest arbitrarily. Now, the truth of the matter is if I wanted to, I could allow limited nesting. I could say you could nest 1 level, 2 levels, 3 levels, 10 levels. I don't know if programming languages do that. They could do it. The scanner would be more complex. But we're doing the general problem. Can I nest arbitrarily? In real programs, you can for other things like parens or fors or anything. I can have a loop within a loop within a loop within a loop as deep as I care to make it. And there's no limitation. But in this case, nested comments do not work. And it's because comments are handled by the scanner. And the scanner has this problem of nesting. At some stage, we may want to go back and rethink all this, but a lot of this notation is so well-developed, we kind of are stuck with it. Comments ought to look like comments have always looked, and if we change them, people get a little antsy about, why are you changing things? I like it the way I like it. Oops. There we go. So this is just what I said there, that this set is known not to be regular. We'll prove that. And it's going to be a really easy proof down the line. And if I write a regular expression that tries to do that, like something that allows you to nest slash star, star slash comments, that's the same thing where left bracket is just slash star and right bracket is star slash. That cannot be done. It can to a finite depth, but not to an unlimited depth. And it's just simply the mathematics behind it does not allow it. Okay, we're going to change pace just a little bit. I've shown you the regular expression notation, but notice the strength of the notation is also its weakness. The strength is that it simply is a definition, but we're implementers. It doesn't tell you how to implement something. And it happens that we're going to need to come up with a mechanism that's very well suited for scanning. And then I'll show you mechanically how a tool like JLEX is able to take a regular expression, which is what you'll write down, and transform it into these devices called finite automata that are really very nicely designed for scanning. Essentially, all they say is read a character, do this, read a character, do that, the very simplest level that you could imagine. So we're going to call these a finite automaton. Why? Well, finite means that it doesn't have an infinite size or capacity. Well, duh, almost nothing does. In mathematics, there's all kinds of infinities. In fact, I know we have at least one ex-mathematician here. One of the coolest things that mathematicians do is show that some infinities are bigger than others. If you're not a mathematician, you never heard that, right? But you've heard about it, right? And it's really kind of a crazy thing. That means the number of integers is infinite. The number of real numbers, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, is infinite. But it turns out the infinity of real numbers is bigger than the infinity of integers. And you know, if you've got a touch of a mathematician, this is really cool, but it's also insane. And it turns out, but it is true. And in this particular case, we're going to stick with finite stuff because we're going to implement them on real machines, which of course are finite. Now, even if you go into virtual memory or something, there's still a lot of memory there, but not infinite. So that's why it's called finite. Automaton is simply a fancy schmancy name for a machine. We use machine for everything. So finite machines would be fine, but automaton is a machine. You know, in the old days, you wouldn't call machines machines. They were called automata. Automata is, by the way, the plural of automaton. So, and again, why? It's probably because of Greek or something where it doesn't have the regular structure that most English words have. So for our purposes, what's cool about this is that we can actually see the machine's logic as part of its definition. And it turns out to be a very simple notation. So what we'll have is a finite set of states. States really just represent a partial scan where you've recognized a certain amount of information but not others. So being in a state tells you something, as we'll see in a moment. You have a set of transitions. Those are simply denoted as arrows that say, I can go from this state to that state if my next input character to be matched is as specified. We have a single state that's very special called the start state. By the way, if you were in 367 and you saw all this, this is essentially going to end up looking like a topological sort of situation where you have one or more starts and you have... Remember when we wanted to do sorts that says, show me all the states that precede another state? This is a mechanism that actually uses that. And we'll have a subset of start states called final states or accepting states. And all this is a thumbs up or a thumbs down. So thumbs up means, yes, it's a valid token. Thumbs down says, no, it's not a valid token. It might be a prefix, but by itself, it's not valid. And that's one of the things your scanner has to do. I'll throw some characters at you and you say, is this good or bad? Later on, you're going to have to say, not only is it good, but here's what it is. Maybe it's a number. Maybe it's an identifier. But you have to say, yes, this is valid, or no, the sequence of characters is not valid under my definition. And this is one of the things it does automatically. Now, what we'll do typically is actually draw these out. And we won't program them this way. Remember, we're drawing this out simply as a way of representing the logic of a program. So what will happen is we'll write down regular expressions, which will translate into these graphs, as I'll show you in a moment. And the graph is used as the logic diagram for a real honest-to-gosh program that does the matching. The cool part is it does the matching without you programming it. All you have to do is say what I want, translate it into these machines that do the matching, and the actual implementation is handled automatically. So a single circle is a state. Oftentimes I'll write a number on it just so that I can say state 3 or state 5. The arrow will typically have a symbol on it saying I can go from one place to another via this arrow. A state that has an arrow coming in from nowhere is the start state. So the little pointer saying here's where you start. And I can have zero or more double circles that say I'm a winner. Anything that's not a winner is a loser by contrast. And let's actually take a look at one. So the notion is we'll start at a start state. I don't know where that A came from. I guess I didn't blot things out totally. We'll get to that in a moment. And you start with a start state and keep reading characters until you either can't go any further or run out of characters. And then you say, if I'm in a double circle, I'm a winner. If I'm not in a double circle, I'm a loser. And I still got that arrow that's from the bottom. So here's a regular expression that's not too hard, but let's first kind of do it in English and then see how we would program it up. So this says, I want to match an A and a B. That's not enough, though. I also have to match one or more C's. That's what the plus is. And that group of A, B, and C's can be repeated one or more times. Now, finally, we'll get that dangling A. Here's a diagram that does exactly that, but this thing is great for matching because the way it works is it says start at the very left, check a character. If I can match a character, I follow the arrow. If I can't match a character, I stop. If I run out of characters, I stop anyway. And if I end up in a double circle state, I'm a winner. If I don't end up in a double circle state, I'm a loser. And that's all there is to it. You can imagine each of these circles representing a bit of code that's an if statement. So it's saying, if you see an A, continue on. If you don't see an A, stop. If I'm in state 2, if I see a B, I continue on. Otherwise, I stop. If I'm in state 3 from the left, I see a C, I continue on. Otherwise, I stop. If I'm in state 4, I see a C, I continue. If I see an A, I continue. If I see a B or a C, I stop. And because the logic is so straightforward, it's easy to run. And yet this matches exactly what that regular expression shows. Excuse me. So let's kind of figure out and see, it does it match what it should and does it reject what it should? So question to the audience, is ABC a legal string under that regular expression? The answer is yes, it is, because it says match an A, match a B, one or more C's, one C is fine, and it says match that sequence one or more times, one is fine. So let's look at our automaton. Read an A, go to state 2, read a B, go to state 3, read a C, go to state 4, reading left to right, and that's a winner. So that's legal. What about A, B, C, C? Should that be allowed? If you look at it, it says, yes, I can read an A and a B, and then that plus C can read two C's rather than one, and then stop. So go to A, B, C, and notice it can loop on C, so that's fine. That bottom path says you can read A, B, and any number of C's, and that's fine. But then that top arrow says, hey, you can repeat the process. So if I want to read another A, I go to the second state. That's where I typically go if I see an A, and then read another B, another C, and additional C's. It also excludes things. Can I read an A, B, C, B? That should be excluded. So if I read an A, B, C, go to the last state on the right, and it's got no arrow for a B. So it says no, At that stage, no, you can't read any further. It stops at the prefix that's legal and doesn't read any additional illegal characters. So in that particular case, it does what we want. So the notion is you'll program a regular expression, something like in the middle. It'll translate to a logical diagram in the center. And as I'll show you shortly, use that as the basis for a program logic that's ordinary Java-like code. So the kind of automata that we're talking about are the good kind of automata. There are good automata and there are bad automata. But it turns out, fortunately for us, that there's used to be a principle that says there's a person named Father Flanagan who ran Boys Town. And they used to have a motto. Does anybody ever know what the motto was at Boys Town? There's no such thing as a bad boy. Well, it turns out that, as we're going to learn, there's no such thing as a bad automaton. It could be misled or had a wild and dissipated life, but we can change it into a good automaton. And what we'll start out with are the good automata. We'll show you how things can go bad and then show you how we can kind of convert them back to the straight and narrow. So in a good automaton, you always have exactly one transition for any character or no transitions. If there's no transition, that just means stop immediately. You do not have a situation where you can have multiple choices. That's an automaton. Nor do you have to worry about matching lambda. That may bother you. You say, hey, lambda's the invisible character. How do I match it? Turns out you don't match it. It's simply a situation. The way you handle lambda is by not matching. Lambda says you don't have to read anything. You can just simply go ahead and stop at this point. So let's see how that works. Well, a finite automaton that's good, deterministic, always has a unique transition for any state and character. And if it doesn't have a transition, that simply means stop scanning. You're done with the process. So these are easy to program. And as we'll see, they actually are used to build the scanners that JLEX is going to generate. It's possible, and we'll talk about this later, to have an automaton that has multiple transitions under the same character or actually a transition under lambda. Those are much harder to scan, so what we'll do is we'll go ahead and show you an algorithm that converts a bad automaton, one that's non-deterministic, into a good automaton that is deterministic. And that's exactly what the scanner generator does. We don't appreciate it. It takes a regular expression and builds first a non-deterministic automaton, one that's not good for scanning. It then converts it to be a good automaton instead of a bad automaton, and then generates code from that good automaton. And I'll show you at least part of that right now. Well, let's look at a deterministic automaton. Well, first of all, we can't conveniently find paper. No, I've got to find plenty of paper. The question that may have struck your mind is, how in the world do I program something that's inherently two-dimensional? I might have something like this. And by the way, what does that match? Just so that we can be clear on it. This is a pretty simple one. And this is the start right there. So it's got to begin with an A. What can it then do? It can read, B+, B star, and then C. So this is simply an implementation of A, B star, C. You say to yourself, well, no, why don't I use the bottom? Well, notice the bottom has a choice that's not easy to program unless you go to the top. Namely, B star says zero or more. How do I know how many to match? The answer is I create a device that matches as many as is needed. It says read an A, gets you to a situation where you can read a C immediately. That's equivalent to having B star match lambda. Or I can cycle, reading 1B or 2Bs or 3Bs, and then finally I have to end up with a C. So this sort of thing, how would I possibly represent that in a computer? Remember, I can have as many circles as I want, as many arrows as I want. And as I'll show you, the easy way to do that is convert it into something computers are comfortable with, namely a table in memory. So in this case, we'll give these state numbers. So I'll have state 1, 2, and 3. And in this case, I have just three characters I care about, A, B, and C. And a table indexed by a state number and a character either is blank or it has a target number. So it says one scene in A goes to 2. 2 scene of B stays in 2. And 2 scene of C goes to 3. And blank means empty or error. Notice that this gives you the same logic as the above. I have to have a separate vector that says the only final state is state 3. And now I want to say, where do I go? I say I start in state 1 and I see an A. Oh, go to state 2. I'm in state 1 and I see a C. Nope, you can't go anywhere. Stop. Is state 2 final? No. So a singleton A is not legal. How about AB? Start at state 1. A takes you to state 2. State 2, scene of B, goes to state 2. And if I try to stop at that point, state 2 is not final. So it says, no, that's a prefix, but it's not an entire valid input. So the diagram up above is easy for humans to read, not so clear how you implement it. But if we do this notion of a transition table, it turns out I can implement any automaton I want. If I have lots of states, the table gets very high. If I have lots of characters, perhaps 128, it gets pretty wide, but memory is pretty cheap, so that's not a big issue. So that's essentially the approach we're going to take. Turns out if we want, we can even do a little bit better and translate from this automaton to real honest-to-gosh code that doesn't even use a transition table. The cool thing about a transition table is I change the table, I can have lots of subprograms out of a library that work with any table at all. That's exactly what JLEX does. It has some code that expects a table. It doesn't know how big that table is going to be until you give a specification, but it works no matter if the table is pretty small, like this guy, or quite large. You might have a table, for example, that has 100 states. It turns out as your scanner is being generated, it'll tell you how many states it created, and it's usually its width is equal to the number of characters that you can possibly have. In our case, we're doing ASCII, which is 128. So it might be 100 by 128, but of course in modern computers, that's a fairly small amount of memory and fits very conveniently in anybody's computer, so it's not a big issue. In the old days, people worried about compacting tables, but that's back when computer memory was expensive. Now it's a good deal cheaper and it's not a big issue. So what we're going to do is we're going to create a transition table that I just showed you, and it's a two-dimensional table indexed by a state number, typically starts at 0 or 1, and a vocabulary symbol. But remember, individual characters are really numbers, aren't they? So they're very usable. If I say character A, that's really just an abbreviation for whatever number is assigned to character A in the ASCII character set. You can bring up documentation that says, this character has number so-and-so, that character has number so-and-so. Some of those you remember, some of them you don't. But each of them has a number. So I say index by a character, I really mean by its character number. And therefore, that works beautifully. Having two-dimensional arrays indexed by two numbers is very routine and it's programmed. In fact, we'll tell you in future how it's actually programmed in a compiler. But it's something very routine and not the least bit unusual. So let's go ahead and look at this example I had previously. This is a pretty simple comment, but it's something very similar to what you have. The difference in yours is you don't require the final EOL. I included this because that's the way it's done in the textbook, and I didn't want to be more confusing than I had to. But a common alternative is to define a single line comment as 2 slashes, anything that's not an end of line character. That's any of the 127 other characters. And then the end of line character, which is the 128th character. So there's the diagram, and notice it does just what I said. It reads one slash, reads a second slash. It can then match an end of line immediately, or it can read any number of non-end of line characters, and finally goes to state 4, end of line, and terminates. And there's the transition table. So in this particular case, you can read it easily. State 1 scene a slash goes to state 2. State 2 scene a slash goes to state 3. State 3 scene a slash, which is included and not EOL, stays in state 3, etc. State 4 has no entries at all, which means once you get there, you're done. You don't can't scan anything further. So at this stage, you stop and you say winner. Anything that's not in state four is a loser. And it's a very nice translation. So it turns out that I can actually create the automaton in two forms. One is I can take this table directly and write a piece of code that uses the table as a parameter and a little bit of extra information like how many states do I have and which are the final states and create a table-driven form. That's, by the way, what JLEX is going to do. I can also do an alternative where I actually change this into real honest-to-gosh Java code. The trouble with this is that if I change the scanner in the least, the code will change quite substantially, and we'll see later on why that's possibly a negative. But we can actually do that, and the second form is sometimes a little bit faster. If real fast scanning is an issue, you can do that second form and get a faster still scanner. Yeah, that's what I wanted to get to. So look at how simple the code is. Now, the actual code would actually be a little bit more detailed than this. This is an outline. But this is essentially the outline of all you have to do if you have this transition table I showed you to actually implement a scanner. So the steps are you give it a regular expression. It translates it into finite automata represented as a transition table that is indexed by state in one direction and character in the other and runs this logic. So we'll assume the states are numbered. That's easy enough to do. We've already done that. And each character really means the number of the character in the character code. So it says, let's start at the start state. Well, while true, wait a minute, that's an infinite loop. Why would I ever write a while true? A loop that loops forever is not a good idea. But why is it legal in this case? Because it's got breaks. So it's saying, and sometimes if I didn't have a break, I might have a return. So that sort of thing says keep iterating indefinitely until something interesting happens. So the reason I mention that is sometimes people are tempted when they write a compiler to say, hey, if you write a program that's bad, I won't compile it. And one of the obvious things to say is if I write a while loop that is while true, that smells like an infinite loop. Should I allow it? Well, you didn't know before. Now what's the answer? You better. Otherwise, you won't be able to do this sort of thing, which is a reasonable thing. Just because it loops forever in the control doesn't mean you might not have something inside like a break, continue, I guess, wouldn't help, or a return. Or maybe even throw an exception. Java, you know, loves to throw exceptions. Something. So it's just a little sideline that sometimes odd-looking code really makes good sense. And this thing is perfectly reasonable. So in this particular case, many systems have not an end-of-file character, but an end-of-file state. To simplify things, we're going to pretend there's an end-of-file character. What turns out in some languages, like C, what you can actually do is represent end-of-file by a negative character. Notice that ASCII characters, you only use 7 bits. The unused bit is the sign bit, and I can actually use negative characters to extend my character set. But that's neither here nor there. But let's simply allow that usage to make the program a little easier. It says, am I in a situation where I'm at end of file? The way we'll do that is we'll create a magic end of file character, different than everything else, that only appears once at the very end of every file. If the file's totally empty, then there's an end of file character and nothing else. Again, it's not necessarily clear that all systems represent things that way, but logically you certainly could. All that means is when you hit end the file reading, you add this extra final character to the input sequence that this sees. So I have a variable called start state, and I say, a constant called start state, and it said my current state is the start state, typically either state 1 or 0, depending on where you start. It says, while true, if I'm at the current character is end the file, I can't match end the file. That's not a real character. I am done. I break and go to that little thing in the bottom, which I'll get to shortly. Otherwise, I go to the transition table and index by the state and the current character. That's either a number or a blank, where blank is a representation of error. Again, you don't have to think of blank. It could be 0 or minus 1 or something. Blank is just easier for humans. So I say the next state is either a valid state or an error state. If the next state is the error state, break, that means I can't continue scanning because there's no place to go. Otherwise, I update my state to be the next state, the target of the transition. I read a character. I'm assuming that's some subroutine that reads characters, reads from the input character by character, and go back. Eventually, I either run out of characters, hit end the file, or I hit a situation where there's no transition, and I go to the bottom. And I say, is state an accepting state? Okay, fine. I say, this is a valid token. I'll process it somehow. Otherwise, well, I'll let you fill that in. I have some kind of error situation. I'll probably want to signal some error saying, hey, the sequence you gave me is invalid. It doesn't form any valid token. And that's something we'll need to do when we do our scanner. And there are ways of doing it that are fairly automatic. So, pretty cool. And it turns out even this thing is pre-programmed for you. So all you have to do is write your regular expressions, translate them into the finite automata, let the finite automata be represented as a transition table, and then run this thing. This is sometimes called a driver because it drives the process. Its code changes very little. All that really changes is the table and the number of states and the number of final states. But pretty easy thing to utilize. If I want, I can even go further and take the logic in the transition table and change this into honest-to-gosh code. The advantage of this is twofold. Well, there's one positive and one negative, actually. The positive thing is this is readable. I've created a piece of code that you might have written by hand automatically. The thing that's nasty about this is if I change the definition of tokens slightly, this code may change quite drastically, and I have to go from an old scanner to a new scanner. Why that's possibly dangerous is if I went in there and I did some changes, like I said, signal lexical error. Well, if I generate a new code for a new set of tokens or an extended set of tokens, all the spots where I edited this code, I have to re-edit it. So it's a situation where it's not clear this is totally a big win, but it's kind of cool to see. If I asked you to write a scanner, you'd probably come up with something like this from the definition. You actually say, is the character equal to a slash? I pulled that out of the table and identified it. It says, if you're a slash, I keep going. If you don't start with a slash, in this case, I'm just doing comments. In general, I'd, of course, be scanning other tokens, but this case, just a comment. So if I don't start with a slash, bingo, that's a loser. So a single slash would possibly be a divide sign, but we don't know about that yet. We only know about comments. So if it's not a slash, it's an error. Otherwise, I read a character. If the character is a slash, I'm good. If it's not a character, not a slash, and that includes possibly that end the file character, then I signal a lexical error. Otherwise, what do? I keep reading characters until I read one of the characters that stops this loop. Remember, we had that loop in the automaton, and it says if I hit an end of line, that stops with a winning state. If I hit end the file, that stops with a losing state because I didn't see my end of line. I then shoot down to the bottom and say, is the current character an end of line? If so, I finished off the way I should. I've got a valid token. Otherwise, I terminated it incompletely or incorrectly, and I have lexical error. So I could also have it generate real code that kind of is readable. And again, that's a plus and a minus. If the token set is never going to change, then you start with that and start editing it. But if the token set ever does change, then you have to regenerate and re-edit the code. That's the downside, possibly. But still a cool idea. So in this case, it's hardwired in, and that's more efficient speed-wise, but it's very specific to a particular token or set of token definitions. Let's look at a few more examples, because we're going to have to get to those in the final session. So here's the thing I promised you earlier, and now we're going to do right. Remember, we tried the D plus dot D plus. That didn't work. That worked, but it was not general enough. Remember, then we tried D star dot D star. That didn't work because it allowed D dot right in the middle and nothing else. The claim is this thing should work. But wait a minute. Here's a downside of regular expressions. Namely, they can get fairly complex. And maybe you're better at reading this than I am. And you say, yeah, it kind of looks plausible, but I'm not going to bet my lunch money on this being right. But here's the case. Suppose I go ahead and translate it to this automaton, and I can do that automatically. So the guy up top corresponds to that. I'll walk you through it in a moment. And the thing at the bottom, I say, okay, does that thing do what I want? I want it to do four things. That's why I'm holding up five fingers. So I want it to do four things. I want it to read digits, dot digits. That's digits on either side. So let's try that. So I go down the bottom path and I go read a digit. Then I read additional digits, read the dot. That takes me to the center right. And that's a final state. And then I read extra digits. So will it read 12.34? The answer is yes, it will. But I want it to do more than that. I want it to read 12 point, where I stop at the decimal point. Take the bottom path, 12, and at that particular point, read the dot, and at that stage, stop, and I'm in the right center final state. Actually, it turns out it does read five things because it can also read something without a decimal point. Let's try that. If I want to read, go ahead and just read 1, 2, 3. I probably want to allow that. So in this case, 1, 2, 3 takes me to bottom center, keeps going, and it stops when I run out of digits. So it actually accepts 1, 2, 3. Will it accept 0.12, read a dot, go to the center state? Hey, it doesn't stop there. So it will not accept a single dot, the thing I didn't want. But if I read a dot and then some digits, it'll take me to the center right, and bingo, I'm set. So with a little bit of just eyeballing, you say, hey, that guy does the thing I want. But I have to write something like that up there. And let's see if the thing up top really does specify what I want. So you see the thing up top says, I got to see a sequence of digits. And that's kind of take me down the bottom path. I can then stop. So I have a final state and the bottom center. Or I can read a decimal point. That'll take me to the far right center. Or I can read zero more digits. So in that particular case, the zero digits takes me to the top center and read one or more digits. That takes me there. Or I can read additional digits, dot, and digits, and it'll take me to bottom center and right. So it's not as easy to appreciate, but that regular expression can be converted into the thing at the bottom, which I think is fairly understandable. And that's one of the cool dualities here. You can think of programming either at the regular expression notation or the finite automaton notation, and there's a rule that says they're both interchangeable. You give me the bottom, I can generate the top, or the center, and you give me the center, I can generate the bottom. So it's just a matter of, like, if you're multilingual, you can read a book in English or French, whatever it is, you know, and whichever you prefer. I really hate, you know, when one of my colleagues says, have you ever read Madame Bovary? Oh, yeah, sure, in French. Mm-mm. And so they always have a chance to get you. I haven't read it in French. I assume it's originally in French, right? Flaubert? I hope. Anybody study French literature? Great way to be unemployed. I guess, no, you got jobs, so you sure didn't. So let's look at something here. This is a tad more complex, just to show you the power. This thing contains letters and digits. I already showed you that. And underscores. It's got to begin with a letter and allows no adjacent or trailing underscores. So let me show you an example of what I'm including and excluding. And again, this is, you say, well, I don't like that definition. Fine, change it. That's the cool thing. You make the definition, and the scanner is your slave in the sense it does what you tell it to do. If you tell it to do the wrong thing, it's your problem. You're the boss, and you gave it the wrong def. So what things is this would allow A or AB or AB3, the ordinary sort of thing. It would allow an underscore in the middle, but a singleton, like cost of 1. And identifiers that allow that, those are used. If you're in a language that doesn't allow underscores, you kind of change case or something like that. That would be allowed, but you're not allowed to have two consecutive underscores. The argument there is if you have two or three or four, it gets pretty hard to read. And you'll see that the consecutive underscores even fool PowerPoint a bit. So you wouldn't be allowed, you wouldn't be able to say cost total. You could have one underscore, but not two. And I kind of separated them to make it clear that there are two. You may have noticed on some printouts, the underscores kind of bleed together, and that's one of the negatives. And you're not allowed to have a leading underscore, like underscore in or underscore out. And it turns out that some systems actually use identifiers with a leading or trailing underscore for internal names that users are not allowed to use. If you ever study Unix or systems like that, sometimes they reserve that form of identifier for internally generated names, so you can't accidentally clash with something that the operating system creates. So that's the logic of what I might want. Let's go actually see how we go and do it. So here's the definition, and let me just... So here's the case. Notice that the bottom line, I kind of fooled PowerPoint. I had two consecutive underscores, and it thought I meant an underbar. That's one of the things, I guess, if you ever use Word, if you have two consecutive underscores or three, it changes it into kind of a horizontal line. And again, I didn't know how to tell it not to do that. So let me finish my thing here. So that grand total really is meant to be grand two underscores total. So since we had the ticker there, I think it's a good place to stop. What we'll do is we'll look at the definition, and then we'll look at the automaton and again see the correspondence of what it allows and disallows. The expression, I think, is kind of hard to read, because notice I have a star, and my gosh, I have a plus nested inside of a star. And this is the power, but it's also the difficulty, because how do you know when to use those pluses and stars? The answer is you don't know. You don't worry about it. The scanner figures it out automatically, and we'll see that when we see the automaton. Let me just put that up there, right there. And notice that thing's way simpler, to my thinking, than the thing in the center. So we'll talk about how the bottom thing works and how it's generable from the center guy, and then we'll go on, and most of our final session we'll be talking about the project I handed around to give you a heads up starting on that. So this is a good place to stop. And let's take about 10 minutes, so get here about 5 of 8, and we'll try to get you out of here then before 8:30.